The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. In the late fall of 2006, I visited the battlefield of Little Bighorn for the first time, and among the most moving monuments that I came across on those haunted plains was the monument to the horses, those who carried Custer's soldiers, as well as those who carried Lakota braves who died in that battle. Months after I returned here to L.A., I came upon Deanne Stillman's stunning essay about the horse Comanche, the so-called lone survivor of the Little Bighorn. Comanche, Stillman writes, made his first official appearance in the record on April 3rd of 1868, sold to the Army for the going rate of $90. When I saw that Deanne's essay was excerpted from a forthcoming book, I was really excited and resolved to invite her to Aloud. So here we are tonight to celebrate a remarkable book, Mustang, and to learn about what tonight's moderator and equestrian Samantha Dunn calls the tragic journey that the noble horse has endured in creating the nation we are today. Deanne Stillman grew up around horses, racetracks, and people whose best friends and saviors, she writes, were horses. Her divorced mother was, for a while, the first female exercise boy in the country, breezing around the track at Thistledown Racetrack in Cleveland, Ohio. Stillman is the author of the critically acclaimed bestseller, 29 Palms, A True Story of Murder, Marines, and the Mojave, just published in a new updated edition. 29 Palms was an LA Times best book of 2001 and a finalist for the Southern California Booksellers Association Nonfiction Award. Her work has been published in many places, including the LA Times, Slate, the LA Weekly, New York Times, Boston Globe, Huffington Post, and Rolling Stone Magazine, and many other places. And her plays have won prizes in theater festivals around the country. In conversation tonight with Deanne is Samantha Dunn, who is the author of Failing Paris, a finalist for the Penn West Fiction Award in 2000, and the memoirs Not by Accident, Reconstructing a Careless Life, a BookSense 76 pick, and Faith in Carlo Gomez, a memoir of salsa, sex, and salvation. Her work is anthologized in a number of places, and she is a widely published journalist. Her work has appeared in the LA Times, O Magazine, Ms., and Shape, and she teaches in the UCLA Writers Program. And when I phoned her today to speak to her, she had just returned from shoveling horse manure. She and her husband own two Mustangs, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that tonight as well. So please welcome Deanne Stillman and Samantha Dunn. Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for braving the traffic tonight to have a conversation with my friend Deanne Stillman. Oh, wait, I never met you before in my life, right, but it's the first time.
I'm not sure how I got here.
Yeah, I don't know. Deanne and I do know each other. I'll just break the news right now.
Okay, I'll move up, yeah.
Am I okay, Louise? Huh? Okay.
Are we on?
Okay. So girl walks into a bar. A girl walks into a bar.
Sorry. Horse walks into a bar.
No. Oh, that's right. You were going to tell your joke
first. Why the long face?
Why the long face? Get it?
Bartender says, why the long face? Yeah.
Well, in your case, a girl really did walk into a bar.
That's
in 1991.
Oh, right, I did.
You did, in fact.
Yeah, right.
In 1991.
Okay.
And you'd been hiking in the Joshua Tree, walk into a bar in the desert, hear a story over drinks about some murders of two girls. Local Marines from the 29 Palms base were suspects, or I don't even remember if that was the case. Anyway, that ends up becoming 29 Palms, which in my mind is truly a seminal work of true crime. I mean, it's really one of the modern masterworks in that genre, to me.
Yeah, right.
To me. You too, probably.
I kind of liked it.
So then, about 7 years later, She's walking into another bar in the desert. We're seeing a theme here, Deanne.
I think so.
And you hear stories of horses being killed around Reno around Christmas.
Right.
Gets your attention. And then here, 10 years later, we have the book Mustang, the Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West, which, of course, is our subject tonight. And a couple things occur to me. One, American letters would be much different if you were a teetotaler. And second, there are some similarities in these two works immediately for me. One is that they both are sparked, if you will, by the brutal killings of what some would consider inconsequential beings. The girls in 29 Palms were called trash. They were called no accounts. The horses, the wild horses of the West, are considered parasites by some, by many,
right.
in control,
right.
And scabs and invasive species. So I was curious, and the landscape of the American West is so strong as to be its own character in your work. And I was curious if those were the hooks to get you into this work for 10 years. Was that what gripped you at first?
Those really were two of the strongest hooks. There are two rivers in my life that always seem to converge in my writing. Grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and I had a kind of a peculiar riches to rags upbringing. when my parents were married, we had an upper middle class life, and I had private French lessons and tailor made clothing. And my mom was an expert equestrian and had show horses and taught me and my sister to ride. And
the Hunt Club circuit.
On the Hunt Club circuit, yes, in Cleveland. And then one day it all came to a crushing halt, and my mother and sister and I moved to literally the wrong side of the tracks across the street from the racetrack. And my mother's most immediately marketable skill was horseback riding, and she got a job on the track as one of the first women in the country to work as an exercise boy. Mm-hmm. And my sister and I used to spend a lot of time with her at the track and found a great deal of comfort around the horses and in the stables. And I always was quite taken with their service. I mean, I knew from having grown up around them that they were incredibly noble and loyal and just gave and gave and gave, and then here we are, we're on the track in this community of misfits and outcasts, and everybody's best friend was the horse. And then something else happened at the same time. Because we were living on the wrong side of the tracks, I found out at a very early age what this country thinks about the working class. Because even some of our own relatives stopped talking to us, and suddenly we were outcasts and misfits, like a lot of the horses who were, you know, carrying us all across the finish line. These weren't celebrity horses. They were just kind of workaday nags that were doing their job. And right. So I just always felt an affinity for the voiceless in a lot of ways, whether people or animals. Mm-hmm. And had always wanted to, when I grew up, I wanted to live in the West and be a writer in addition to continuing my writing. And then when I did finally come west, I started spending a lot of time in Joshua Tree National Park and other places in the desert, and started hearing these stories, and they kind of rang me like a church bell on D-Day, as I always tell my friends.
Yeah, there definitely has to be an emotional pull, because I'll tell you, it is a tough saga, the saga of the horse in the West, and you witness all of it. I don't remember if it's in the book or if we were talking, but you mentioned you read some 600 books, is that correct?
Well,
you did an incredibly exhaustive research for this work that looks not only at, you know, the killings in Reno 10 years ago were the spark, but you talk about the horse in America from its beginning.
Right.
So, you know, it had to be some emotional beat that kept you going through that difficult story.
Well, I felt when I heard about this when I picked up the newspaper in this bar in 29 Palms, and I had been waiting to interview, I was still finishing up my 29 Palms.
Right. Oh, you were finishing
it. I was finishing it up, and I was waiting to meet with a source, and I picked up a paper, and it said six horses had been killed in Reno in the Virginia Range a couple days after Christmas. This was 1998, and I thought, wow, who would, I didn't know there were horses living in the Virginia Range outside Reno then. Mustangs. I knew there were some wild horses in the country, but I didn't know that. And I was just stunned, and I thought, who would do such a thing? And then a couple of days later, there was another item, and it said there were 12 carcasses found. And then by New Year's Eve, there were 34 carcasses found. And I thought, I've got to tell this story. The horse saved my family's life, I always felt, and from that moment on, it was time for me to repay the favor. So I started looking into it, and it turned into this huge, another 10-year undertaking. Yeah. And I think I read the 600 books for the Little Bighorn chapter alone.
Wow.
Wow. I went back. I found out many astonishing things during the course of my research. But first of all, I found out that the horse is North America's gift to the world. I had no idea.
I had no idea. Horses all my life.
Right.
My uncle was a rancher. My first horse, I was five. I had no idea that this horse was actually an indigenous species initially.
I had no clue.
They came with the conquistadors, right?
Well, they evolved here 55 million years ago. They were this big, the size of a fox terrier. It's hard to imagine. Got bigger and faster, of course, over time. And then during the Ice Age, they were heading across the Bering Land Bridge and populated the rest of the world, but went extinct here. Then they returned with the conquistadors. And I begin my book with the horses, with Hernando Cortez and the 16 horses. I went back into all these old conquistador records and found the names of the 16 horses that came with Cortez.
And their color and their temperament.
Right. I mean, amazing information. And I also found out this shocking thing that thus began a series of shocks that sort of reverberate to this day, that during these conquistador crossings, more than half of the horses died along the way from Spain to Cuba to the New World. And along the equator, the ships would become becalmed and to lighten the load, the conquistadors would throw the horses overboard.
Yes.
And they came to call that part of that area along the equator the horse latitudes, which I didn't know. But at any rate, another half survived the crossings and, permitted the conquistadors to open up, to take over the New World. Yes. And
giving some perspective on what we're talking about now, I mean, the horse, I think you say this in the book, the horse is still being thrown overboard.
Right.
I don't have the statistics, of course, right in front of me, because I should have written them down, and I didn't. But there was something like 3 million horses in America. I'm going to get the statistics wrong. And now there are only 25,000.
What happened was that, I track it from the 16 horses of Cortez who perished during that first entrada, but there's one of the horses had foaled on board, and there's a myth that I recount in that the foal connected with the six surviving horses of the DeSoto expedition. They went north and formed the basis for today for modern Mustang herds. And then there were the subsequent waves of horses coming with the later expeditions. And they, because they were coming home to their ancestral turf, they flourished very well. They hooked up with Native Americans and served in all of our wars. But by the end of the 20th century, there were 2 million of them. But their job was done. I mean, the car had come along, the train was here, the range had been cleared, the buffalo was gone, the Indians were, sent to reservations, and these massive roundups began. And so here we are today, where there are only about 23,000 at most living on the range in the 11 western states with dwindling protections.
And another aspect I wasn't aware of, Nixon was actually a big champion of the, go figure,
I know.
Was actually a huge champion of the wild horse. And it was the 1971
Wild Free Roaming Horse and Burro Act. Right.
Which has since unraveled
under our
G.
Guy from Texas. Yeah,
the guy who wears the hat.
The guy with the cowboy hat from the state which runs on Mustang Mojo, but which has zero wild horses left at this point. But the story, there was a woman named Wild Horse Annie, an amazing character, amazing
her.
Nevada character.
This is an incredible story. Just start from the beginning of when she sees the horse in the trailer.
Okay, well, she was
story.
A secretary in 1950, and she was driving on her way to work one day.
In Nevada,
In Nevada, on a desert highway, and saw some blood spilling out of a truck hauling, blood spilling out of a truck. She was alarmed and followed it, and it turned in at a slaughterhouse, and she noticed that injured and dying Mustangs were being offloaded at this plant. And she had heard these tales all her life about these terrible, terribly cruel roundups. Some of you may have seen the movie The Misfits, and those were actually happening in massive numbers of horses were being taken off the range that way. And she had heard about this stuff growing up, never believed it. From that point on, she stopped in her tracks and realized that something had to be done about this. And as a secretary, she immediately went to her office and started pounding out letters on her old typewriter, and went through like hundreds of miles of ribbon over the years, and ended up going out to watch, secretly monitoring all these roundups and photographing them with various compadres and lobbying people around the world, and due to her efforts, 20 years later, there were four different bills passed protecting the wild horse, and culminating in the 1971 act that Richard Nixon signed, quoting Thoreau in the process. And, you know, we don't remember him that way, of course. Nixon quoting Thoreau? But he did sign some of the country's most, important pieces of environmental legislation.
My husband's a Republican. He reminds me of this often,
He even had a ceremony at the Rose Garden and made a big deal of it, which he didn't have to do.
Right.
I think is quite amazing. Now, if Wild Horse Annie had not come along and Nixon had not signed that bill, there would be no wild horses today on the range. Mm-hmm. None whatsoever.
None. Wow.
Yeah. None.
That's amazing to think about.
It really is. Yeah.
I don't know how many of you have actually experienced wild horses horses in general, but there's something, I think Deanna and I were talking back in the green room where the artists hang out. There's something about the character of the Mustang that is unique to their species. They're not like any other horse, and there's something that fills you. One of the casualties of your book, as it were, is kind of the myth of the rancher. I wanted to talk a little bit about that, because ranchers throughout the West have been one of the biggest enemies of the wild horse. And it's ironic because I'm the niece of a rancher, so I always thought of, the kind of the West and protecting our Western heritage, when in fact they have laid siege to the wild horse.
They really have. Cattle ranchers and sheepmen as well regard the Mustang as a varmint that steals food from cows. Mm-hmm. Pests, outlaws. The demonizing of the Mustang began round about the time the range closed up and people started to regard it as a cash crop.
Right.
And it is kind of, that was another thing that was surprising to me, that the cowboy who calls his horse Pard and sings all these love songs to him, which I recount in my book, also, the cowboy kind of has a split personality and has turned on the horse. The big question my book asks is, why have we, a cowboy nation, turned on our greatest partner? What does that say about us?
And why have we? I mean, where is that paradox in our psyche?
Well, I think, one of the stories I recount in my book is as Louise had mentioned earlier, the story of Comanche, the horse that survived the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And he was a wild horse taken from what was once called the Great Horse Desert in Texas. That's how many horses there were in Texas after the Civil War. They were just like vast rivers of horse running across Texas. And because many 1.5 million horses and mules had died in the Civil War, and there weren't enough remounts for the Indian War, so the cavalry turned to the wild horse populations of the West, and that's where Comanche came from. And he got the name. He served in various battles with Native Americans and got the name Comanche because during one of them he was hit with an arrowhead in the flanks, and when his handlers went to remove it, he displayed such great stoic courage that they called him Comanche, and thus this legendary horse came into being. Then a couple of years after that, he found himself at the Battle of the Little Bighorn in Custer's Gray Horse Unit. And when that was all over, and the army, a couple of days later, the army stumbles into all this carnage and dead and dying soldiers, and Custer's unit is surrounded by all the horses that they had shot as protection. Out of that stumbles Comanche, this many times wounded war veteran. And there was talk of putting him down, but then he had been shot 8 or 9 or 10 times during that battle. Yeah. And there was talk of putting him down, and then somebody intervened and said, no, this horse has a will to live. And then someone else poured some booze into a hat and offered it to him, and he suddenly came perked up and from then on developed a taste for booze. And
yeah, he became a real alky.
Like other war veterans.
Yeah. Post-traumatic stress.
He did. Yeah. He did.
Luckily, he couldn't deal with a syringe because fingers, but yeah.
But they took him back on a steamer to a nearby fort and nursed him back to health, and he was retired with full honors and given the citation the Great Silent Witness because he had seen so many atrocities. The wild horse has been on the front lines with us since day one. So this is my answer to your question, why this hatred of the wild horse. I mean, it goes beyond greed and getting the animal off the land so we can have more land for ourselves. I think the horse is our conscience in a lot of ways. He is our great silent witness. He's seen us at our best and at our worst. And I think that on some very subterranean level, people feel the urge to destroy it. And I'm not saying that just because of Comanche being called the great silent witness in this army citation. Something else I found out during my research was that there have been a series of atrocities against the Mustang across the West for decades, and they are very heinous. They go well beyond shooting animals to clear them, to get rid of them. The Mustang Massacre that I write about in my book, the Christmas Massacre that happened 10 years ago,
that launched the book.
That launched my book involved. One of the horses had been one of the people who attacked these horses mutilated his eye, and there's the famous British play Equus that maybe some of you recall about, which was based on a series of actual incidents that happened in the British countryside involving a teenager who loved horses but it was roiled by them and ended up attacking 6 horses in a stable in the eye. And it's because I really think it's because the horse has that big satellite eye, and people on subterranean level can't take his gaze. Just the way, and Melville writes the same way. Melville writes about the whale in Moby Dick, and I went back and read that and found a passage about wild horses.
Have that in your introduction.
I mean, it's quite stunning. With the wild, and it's watching us. And here's a picture of bugs, which we'll get into later. Actually, survived that Christmas massacre, and
go into bugs.
Okay,
bugs is here in the corner.
But me and bugs, this horse down here in the corner, was now 10 years old. Bugs was found in the Virginia Range a couple of months after this Christmas massacre in 1998, and she was quite young, and was surrounded by a band of bachelor stallions who had been kicked out of another herd and had been looking after her. And a hiker discovered her and called for help, and I met the two women who rescued her and found her sort of struggling to get up in the brush where she was lying in the middle of winter, and she was like Comanche and had a tremendous will to live. And some people said, let's put her down. Other people intervened and said no. And these women I know in Carson City who run a wild horse sanctuary took her home.
That's very common too. Lots of mom and pop shop rescues.
Exactly. Yeah, all over the country. And so they took her. They took her home and nursed her back to health. And they. She was very skittish, so they named her Bugs. And the name always reminded me of another Nevada character, Bugsy Siegel, himself kind of a, witness to a lot of desert.
Read some bugs.
All right. I'll read you a little bit about this amazing, really amazing Mustang character. Hold on. Let me find it. Okay. When Betty and Bobby trudged through the snow in their lug boots to unhitch the trailer, the hiker and the vet and animal control officer came to help them, and they hauled the trailer across the frozen washes and gullies until they approached the filly about 100 yards away and downhill. The stars were particularly bright that night and helped the rescue party, who were equipped only with flashlights, as they lumbered across the sands and then up the rocky rise where the filly was lying on her side with her head down. The men lifted her onto a platform and carried her down the hill and into the trailer. She was a carcass with a winter coat, Betty later told me. She was covered with ticks and parasites, weak and anemic. She was 6 months old. 2 days later at their sanctuary, Betty and Bobby helped her stand. But she kept falling. Over the weeks, they nourished her, and she grew strong and regained muscle, and she began to walk without falling down. But she was nervous, not skittish as a lot of horses are, especially wild ones, but distracted, preoccupied, perhaps even haunted. Because of her location when rescued, and because she was starving, her rescuers reasoned that she had been a nursing foal who had recently lost her mother. Without mother's milk, a foal can last for a while in the wilderness, sometimes as long as a couple of months. And because a band of bachelor stallions had been nearby when she was found, her rescuers figured that they had taken her in, looking after her until it was time to go, standing guard as she lay down in the brush to die. Something made me stop, the hiker who found the filly later said. Although she could not be returned to the wild, Bugs, I think, was the luckiest horse in Reno. Yeah. So I've spent a lot of time with Bugs over the years, and I want to mention that there are surviving members of her herd still out there in the Virginia range, and they are, should I read the,
sure,
about these other herds? Across the 11 western states now, there are herds remaining, still roaming unfettered in pretty herds, each herd with its own story. The Surbat in Arizona, the Little Book Cliffs in Colorado, in Idaho, the Chalice, and that's the Chalice herd up here running across the bottom and the top as well. The Kiger in Oregon, the Chemehuevi in California, the South Shoshone, the West Douglas, the Sinbad, the Cibola, the herd at Wheeler Pass, the Mustangs at Havasu, the Whistler Mountain Horses, the Four-Leggeds of Jake's Wash, Choke Cherry, Clover Creek, Reveille, and Alamo, galloping, walking, grazing, trying to make more of their own, pawing through the ice in winter to scrounge for forage, appearing in the backyards of the new Levittowns that are replicating across the desert, straddling land where they are federally protected and land where they are not, spreading seeds so new grasses can grow, stopping for a drink, trying to cross highways, fleeing trappers, running from bullets, on they go, but for how much longer we cannot say. They really belong not to man, Will James wrote, but to that country of junipers and sage, of deep arroyos, mesas, and freedom. So I've visited these herds many times, and they really are, you know, is there anyone in here who doesn't like wild horses? Are there any Americans who would say they don't like wild horses? I mean,
I want to ask you about that. It's a complicated question for me as a horse owner and someone who identifies as a Westerner.
Right.
Because as Louise mentioned, we do have a Mustang who was obviously brought in from one of the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management handles the horses. Now there's an Adopt-a-Horse program, but that in itself is controversial. You know, so how do you, is that helping the Mustang to adopt through this program? What is your feeling on what we can do to help the horse? And how are we complicit in what's happening to the horse right now?
Yeah, it's a good question. And let me just explain how the Bureau of Land Management's Adopt-a-Horse program works. Because in most of the areas where the horse still roams, its natural predators are gone. So we have had to become its predator. And in order to cull the herds, there are these roundups every year. And hundreds of thousands of horses have been taken off the range over the past 20 or 30 years. And the way they come up with how many to remove, the way the government figures this out, is range studies. But these, a lot of these studies are out of date and based on science that favors cattle and sheep grazing. And it's to the detriment of the horse. And in fact, there was a GAO investigation right now going on of the whole program. And I document a lot of the problems in this program in my book. There's ongoing disasters with this program. Now, on the other hand, some horses are adopted out successfully. You have some, and other people do. You know, there are a certain number of horses that have to come off the range every year because just because of this, you know, as I said, their predators are gone and so on. And that's fine, but there are far too many horses now in the government adoption pipelines and not enough adopters. And there are more horses in the pipelines than are on the range. Right. And why the fact is, here's an interesting statistic for you, another really astonishing thing I found out. There are about 4 million cattle on public lands right now, and as we said earlier, maybe at most 23,000 wild horses. Mm-hmm. Now, why do we, first of all, these 4 million cattle on the public lands supply the country with 3% of our beef. No. What is this? This is not a gigantic part of our economy. No. But the livestock lobby is very powerful. Right. And here we are at a situation, you know, at a point where we're arguing over, you know, can Montana still have 100 horses? That's the number of horses now left in Montana. Can Nevada, is it okay for Nevada to still have, like, you know, 15,000 horses? It's an absurd discussion. That's how much trouble the Mustang is in. Things are completely out of whack, and I feel it's sort of a scandal that festers under the radar, and I'm trying to give, you know, shine some light on it in my book, because, as I said, here we are about to exit the stage on foot, minus our, right.
Well, and a lot of environmentalists haven't exactly beat the drum either, because they've looked at the horse as an invasive species. They've looked at it as a plague, if you will.
That's true. The environmentalists have not.
Not all. I mean, some, yeah. but definitely not as sexy as the big cats or the wolves.
No,
not that big cats and wolves don't need to be saved. Don't get me wrong, but.
Well, I mean, there is sort of this hierarchy of which animals get to be saved, and there's an ongoing controversy over whether or not the horse is in fact native or feral. And feral in environmental jargon means, you know, weed, and it has to go. But as I said, the horse is native to this country, and is protected. But because of all these sort of issues and ideas roiling around it, it's in a lot of trouble now. And because given the nature of the media today, people have said to me, "Well, we already ran our animal story last week, so we, you know, I mean, it's a story yep. that I don't know. There's just a lot of, you know, it's a big American scandal, in my opinion. You know, no horse, no America. Mm-hmm. A big scandal that." People aren't aware of, but when they find out about it, they're very concerned. I mean, in my travels across the West, whenever people hear about this, the first thing they say is, where can I go see wild horses? I mean, who doesn't, you know, our greatest road trip car is the Mustang with the galloping pony on the grill.
Frederick Remington, I didn't know that. That's another little fact I learned from your book.
Yeah, they got it from Remington. There was the biggest product launch in Ford's history. Mm-hmm. And they got the whole... the idea for the campaign from Remington's paintings.
Well, speaking of people, I have a lot of questions, but I imagine some of you in the audience are curious about what's going on with Deanne and about this book. So is there anything that anybody want to say? Ask? Yes.
Yes, are there any rescue organizations in particular that you would refer us to, you know, given that option?
Yeah, I discussed several of them in the last section of my book called Last Stand, and I document the entire the battle that the horses, as I say, you know, the horses fought our greatest wars and blazed our trails, and it's now fighting a battle for its own life. And there are many organizations around the country, and some of the ones I write about in my book are a really excellent one based here in Central California called Return to Freedom. There's Wild Horse Spirit, women who rescued bugs. They're in Carson City, Nevada. There's the International Society for the Protection of Mustangs and Burros in South Dakota. That's the organization that Wild Horse Annie started and now takes in both Return to Freedom and the South Dakota group rescue entire herds that have been like shoved off the range because that's the only way to conserve them now. And each herd has its own characteristics. Some are direct descendants of the Spanish. Others are cavalry horses and so on. But there are various organizations, you know, that you could get involved with, and as I say, discuss them in my book.
Question over here. Matt and Neil.
Thank you. At what point does the Mustang lose its title as far as the use of the horse?
Oh, you mean when does title pass? I'm not quite sure.
When can you no longer call the horse a Mustang?
Oh, you know, I got confused because the BLM has a term, uses the term, you ran into it when you adopted your horse.
Yeah.
Title passes. The Mustang officially belongs to you after you've had it for a year. When is it no longer wild? It's always wild, in my opinion. You know, the horse is the one animal of service that moves very easily between a barn and the open range. It takes about 2 seconds for a horse to go wild. And particularly,
it's really true.
Yeah.
With a Mustang, they can be tamed, but they are never really domesticated. So I would say they remain Mustang. At least ours have. Wow, maybe we're doing something wrong. There was a woman in the green there. I'm sorry, and then you in the blue.
Thank you. I've forgotten the source, but I read someone advocating Mustang watching, much as how we've done the whale watching, to bring the Mustang.
Oh, yeah.
Would you like to address that? What is your perspective?
Well, ecotourism is kind of now the term being bandied about in terms of Mustang preservation, and you know, it's definitely a way to go. The problem with all of this is we don't want wild horses to end up in zoos, you know, unofficial though they may be. I mean, they are protected by law. The law says, the 1971 law that Richard Nixon signed says they are to be considered in the areas that they are found. Some of these areas are accessible via hiking and four-wheel drive and so on. I'm sorry, what was your question again?
Thank you, Ed.
No, I don't like zoos, so it wasn't right. About that. But, going out, you know, and watching Mustangs.
Yeah.
There was an article just last week about a couple who went out to watch Mustangs, and then they got caught somewhere and almost were stranded and starved. I don't know if you've seen that, but, you know, just I'm not a horse owner,
right.
But I have been doing a lot of avid reading about the Mustang, and I just know that Mustang watching was something that somebody advocated as a way to lift the Mustang's presence up to the public eye, like we have done with the whale.
Yeah, no, it's a great idea, and there are people who run like photography workshops into Mustang ranges, and you know, will take you just camera or no, you know, out to see them. And they are, you know, the one reason they're under siege is because a lot of people don't see them as income producing. And not that wildlife should be income producing, but a lot of game animals are. And that's why another reason that people want them off the range, because, you know, makes them for more forage for trophy animals and so on. But I completely agree with you. If people could, for instance, adopt a Mustang in the wild and track it, just the way some whale preservation organizations, it's certainly something to consider.
Deanna, as you pointed out about the fact that wild animals don't recognize jurisdictional boundaries and sometimes wander out of protected areas. And I was just curious, in terms of the two countries that we border with, Canada and Mexico, where we built this really long fence, to what degree that impacts, if at all?
There are no wild horses in Texas anymore. The horses that were on the border in Arizona are mostly gone. The last herd in Southern California was taken a couple of years ago.
White Sands? White
the White's Karen Sussman, who has the conservancy in South Dakota, has the last of the White Sands herd,
White Sands
which was
New
zeroed
Mexico.
Out in, as the BLM a few years ago, a long while ago. The fence, although that fence does impact other, you know, other animals, other wild animals, and it is, that's why a lot of, you know, environmental groups are suing, but it doesn't cut through any wild horse ranges that I know of. I haven't heard.
Rita, David? Oh, sorry. Woman in the orange and man in the white.
Can you tell me specifically what has happened during Bush's administration in terms of the erosion of protection for the horses?
Yeah, 3 years ago, remember Senator Conrad Burns, anybody from Montana? Another guy with a cowboy hat. He attached something that has come to be known as the Burns Rider to the 05 appropriations bill while everyone was rushing off for Thanksgiving vacation. And it said that horses over 10 or that hadn't been adopted on the third try through the BLM's Adopt-a-Horse program were eligible for sale to the lowest bidder. So that meant, you know, a quick ticket to the slaughterhouse. Shortly after that rider, after the appropriations bill was signed, there were a number of horses that immediately were sent to slaughter. And due to a public outcry, the country's three foreign-owned slaughter plants were shut down, although the horses can still be shipped across the, this is where the border thing comes in, shipped across the Canadian and Mexican border, you know, our borders to plants there, along with domestic horses.
There are fewer regulations, by the way, for humane slaughter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
well, whole other story.
Terrible situation. But that's the unraveling of the bill, and it's just a completely not in the spirit of the original law, and it's really an outrage. And the cattle lobby has been trying to do that since that law went into effect, and they've reached, you know, they have a huge amount of influence now in the Bush administration, as you know, you probably know.
I've had a little bit to do with wild horses in Australia called Brumbies, and they're a particular type, a little bit like those in the bottom left-hand photo. I was curious, though, as to a distinction between wild horses and Mustangs and the coming, sort of the comings and goings from domestic environments to wild environments. The two heavy horses in the pair on the top right look like they have some kind of Clydesdale heavy horse blood.
Uh-huh.
And then this other photo has a brand, which would suggest that that horse has maybe been in some situation. And how does all that work in the context of the Mustang as a breed?
Yeah. Well, each of the herds have their own characteristics. The herd on the lower left here in the upper right, that's a Chalice herd in Idaho. There's a picture of them in my book as well. They have slightly different bloodlines than the scruffier, smaller brown Mustangs of Nevada, like Bugs here.
Which are closer to the original Spanish Barb.
That's right, much closer.
Came over
with
the conquistadors.
Right.
Yeah.
The horse with the Freeze brand has been, that's what happened when they're taken by BLM or other agencies which round them up, they brand them to identify, you know, where they're from and the date taken and so on. This horse was returned. Some of them are injected with birth control and returned. That's one of them. But they all get that Freeze brand. Sam's horse has it.
Yeah.
Any horse that goes through that is culled has that brand. Does that answer all of your questions? Sort of, kind of. I think it can, yeah.
Was there a question down here? Yes, sir. And then you in the back there. Yeah. I think that would be. Louise,
thank you. When I looked at the book on the section on the Misfits film, I felt that maybe it's my misinterpretation as I read the book that you were suggesting that was an anti-Mustang film. And yet when I remember that Roz, played by Marilyn Monroe, had such an important part at the end, I felt like we were saving the Mustang, and I came away from that film feeling, oh, the Mustang is a magnificent animal.
Well, it's a horrifying film, but also an incredible, I mean, a very powerful film, and I certainly didn't intend that chapter to, didn't intend to say that The Misfits is an anti-Mustang film at all. I used it as that comes at the end of my chapter about the horses that build Hollywood, and you know, here's another thing, the movie industry that wouldn't exist without wild horses, really. I ended the chapter with the Misfits because it takes place in Nevada, where most of the country's wild horses still roam, and the reason most of them are still in Nevada is because they went there to hide from the tentacles of civilization that have been like pursuing them, you know, everywhere, and they moved into the higher elevations to get away from mankind. Just, you know, a lot of people go to Nevada to hide. I'd go there if I wanted to get, so
yeah.
I mean, so Mustangs are there for a reason, and that's why I ended that chapter with the Mustangs and with the Misfits. And you'll see the last picture in my book is there's still a herd of Mustangs living on what came to be known as Misfits Flat, because that's where the movie was filmed.
A note on that movie, though, it ends happily, the movie ends happily, but Miller's short story does not.
That's right.
Big downer. I won't tell you, but you can guess. Yes. Okay. Well, and then there's someone up here. Yeah.
I've been shooting wild Mustangs for about 5 years. I've been going out several times a year and camping out for a couple weeks at a time and following around different herds in Montana and Nevada and Utah and just hanging out with them all day and all night. It's been fascinating, to say the least. And I've seen the numbers go down so drastically. And so I started watching the BLM numbers that they issue about how many horses are left in their particular areas with their counts. The last numbers that I read is that there are 6,000 at the high estimation in all of the BLM managed areas. There in all the states, the high number was 6,000. Now, they ran out of money this year. I talked to a BLM guy that runs Ridgecrest. They ran out of money this year, so they can't round up anyone. But their proposed roundups were 4,500 horses out of the 6,000 that are left in the United States.
Well, I've seen that low number, and of course, the government's figure is higher, and government agencies always lie.
And that was the government agency's number of how many there are left and how many they were going to gather this year.
I'm not disputing you. I don't know
if that's true. Do you? I mean, so you say at the beginning when I walked in, I think it was late, that there are 20,000 left in the United States, and according to the numbers I've been reading, there's 6,000 left.
I'm just throwing that out as a BLM. I don't know for sure. However, 20,000 is not enough. People say, scientists say that each herd needs at least 100 horses to remain genetically viable. Some of the herds are way below 100 now.
They're so small. I'm seeing herds with a stallion, a mare, and the new baby.
It's an outrage. Whatever the figure is, 20,000 or 6,000, it's very disturbing. And I wrote an op-ed in the LA Times a few weeks ago calling for a moratorium on all roundups until the studies are brought up to date. And it's not the first I've called for it. I did it a couple of years ago on July 4th on the Huffington Post, and I'll do it again. And I'll do it here. I'm calling again for a moratorium.
But thank you for your work in the book, and it wasn't to dispute you, just as awareness of possibilities of other numbers.
No, I agree with you.
Yeah, and thank you for your work.
We have one more question here in the front.
I've heard of Return to Freedom, and I gather they have a very large piece of property north of Santa Barbara.
Right.
And I was wondering, how did she get this property? It's a huge place from what I hear. Was this government land? Do you know anything about it?
I don't know how Nena DiMaio acquired the property. It wasn't government land, but all the conservancies and rescue nonprofit organizations around the country have purchased or leased land, and they're all struggling for donations in these cash-strapped times. All of the people whom I know in the world of wild horse advocacy have totally given over their lives to the situation. But you could email Return to Freedom and ask directly.
Deanne, what is the one thing that you would love for everyone to walk away from the experience of your book? I mean, I'll tell you what I got.
Okay.
If you can just give the horse a freaking break. Just give them a break. Just a little bit of a break. They have such fortitude and, forgive me for being corny, but such spirit that they will find their path yet again. And I really got this sense that it was a hopeful message at the end, that if we can just give them a break and a big if, they can find their own way. What do you hope? I mean, what?
Well, I certainly agree, and I feel that, as I said earlier, here we have our greatest partner under siege. You know, no wild horse, no America, and we will be diminished if we do not make sure that this incredible animal, you know, that this noble, devoted, beautiful, spirited, four-legged wind drinker, as the Native Americans called him, isn't preserved on its native turf. We need to do what we can. We need to make sure that this animal is given its due. We owe it. It's not just didn't just save my family. It made our country.
Great. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for your attention.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.